Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening and agriculture meant to encourage, educate, and empower local gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing local experts, garden enthusiasts, and local producers. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. On this, the final episode of the first season, we talked to Aaron Young and Bo Burgess of Blood, Sweat, and Food Farms about pasture-raised livestock, taking care of your animals throughout the winter, and ethical butchering. Because of this, we will talk about killing animals and the way to humanely do so. I will let you know before we start talking about this. It's not terribly graphic, but I just want to let the audience know just in case this is something that might bother them. Let's get started. Okay, so first off, can you guys introduce yourselves?
Sure. My name is Aaron Young.
And I'm Bo Burgess. And we're with Blood, Sweat, and Food Farms.
What is Blood, Sweat, and Food Farms? What do you guys do?
So we are a primarily pastured pork, poultry, and lamb operation. We have about 20 acres, 2 miles out East End Road. And we specialize in pasture-raised livestock.
So what are some of the benefits for pasture-raised livestock? I mean, I know that there's ethical, environmental, economic considerations.
I think from a consumer standpoint, it primarily comes down to health. Pasture-raised livestock are healthier for a variety of reasons. One is livestock that eats more of a grass-based or a natural source-based diet has higher concentrations of omega-3s and nutrients that are beneficial as opposed to stuff that's raised in an industrial-style scenario. There's also the fact that the animals are more active, leading a better life, and then just morally, and you know, there might not be a huge amount of scientific evidence for it, but just morally, the quality of those lives are better, and the quality of the people lives raising those animals is better too. So you're getting a health and morally better product as well.
As opposed to if they were raised on feed?
I think it's not just feed. It's important to note that commercial or industrial feed operations are feeding only almost exclusively grain-based feeds, antibiotics, fillers, stuff like that. So feed is a big part of it because the animals that are on pasture are getting way more of their feed from grass or plants. But also, you know, the fact that they're moving and they're not living a life sitting in their own excrement is also important.
Housing plays a big factor in a lot of industrial scale farming. Pigs, for example, they spend their entire lives on a concrete slab. They don't get to see dirt. They don't get to root around in the ground. Oftentimes they're held at concentrations that make them, you know, extremely like aggressive to other animals because they're just bored and kept in really tight confined spaces. So pasture-based livestock are, like Bo said, healthier just in terms of what they're eating, but they're also healthier because they're outside on dirt, exposing to ground, getting to do what their animal nature lets them do. Scratch in the dirt if you're a chicken, or root in the ground if you're a pig. And that's just not something that industrial raised animals get to experience.
For people that were doing small scale animal raising, animal husbandry, livestock, are there any plants that grow here that you wouldn't want, say, your goats or your pigs to eat?
We have a really non-diverse environment when it comes to flora, really. I mean, we're kind of like a pioneer environment, the boreal north, spruce forest in general. There's just not that much biodiversity here. And with a couple pretty uncommon exceptions, perhaps hemlock and monkshood, there's very few things that many well-adapted, I would say, like heritage breeds wouldn't be able to deal with. We've never actually had a poisoning issue with any of our animals. I would say even when those plants are there in some small quantity, animals are generally pretty good about avoiding them and knowing what they are.
So you use the term heritage breed. Could you just describe what heritage breed means?
I would say that heritage, in the popular sense, heritage usually is kind of becoming more of a boutique thing, which is unfortunate for the genetics of the industry. But historically, heritage generally meant well place-based suited multi-purpose livestock strains. In the industrial livestock system, animals have been bred to fill one specific industrial niche. You know, like the cows are the easiest example, I think, for most people to think of, like beef cows, like Angus. You know, these are a dumb beefcakey cow that is bred to grow fast, like put a burger on your table in 22 months, right? Whereas back in the day, you would have more heritage breeds like, say, American Milking Devon or something like this. It's just a cow that's smart. You can milk it. It also yields really good meat, and you could potentially even domesticate it in the form of oxen. So that would be like a traditional tri-purpose breed. And modern industrial agriculture has basically bred every kind of animal that still exists in that system to usually fill one need and fill it very well at the expense of other uses.
So our pigs, for example, they're a heritage breed called Tamworth Hog. They're one of the oldest breeds that are actually described, early described in, they started in Ireland, but then they are described in Britain as early as the early 1800s. One of the reasons that we like to grow them is because they're a much hairier pig than a lot of the other pigs you'd see grown in industrial systems. Those pigs tend to be like pretty hairless because they need to be in close concentration, often hot quarters, and they're also designed to put meat on as fast as possible. But what that means is that they're not able to move around any type of ground more than like a concrete slab very easily. Our Tamworths, on the other hand, they are hairier, so they handle the colder climate a lot better. We actually don't provide any supplemental heat to our pigs in the wintertime, as long as it's, you know, warmer than negative 10, which in Homer it typically is, and they have a buddy. And they're also, they have a taller, longer leg, which means that they can move on pasture a lot better. They're more active foragers. They're looking for their food in the environment more than an industrial raised breed would. What that means is they grow slower. You know, they don't put on meat quite as fast as some of those other breeds that are meant to put on meat as quickly as possible. But with the pasture system that we are doing and just our own experience of working with that livestock, we're looking for something that is hardy and thrifty and can use its environment to its best advantage.
What are some other breeds that are suited? Because besides pigs, you guys have chickens, turkeys.
We have sheep, geese, turkeys, chickens.
Ducks as well.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the sheep maybe?
Yeah. To answer your question though, as to like what breeds are really well suited to this environment, you know, I think we don't often talk about it, but generally people have a very ethnocentric view of livestock. People bring their kind of cultural livestock biases, and the primarily kind of Western European dominated culture tends to bring those kinds of agriculture and livestock with them. The reality is in the boreal north, waterfowl far outperform poultry in the form of chickens. Ducks and geese are not nearly as effective in light cycles with their laying. They're able to get almost all of their nutrition, if not all of their nutrition, during the summer months from forage alone. We don't supplement the feed except for trace minerals for our waterfowl. I find the meat more tasteful. It's also healthier for you, like duck eggs, which we also sell, are higher in omega-3 fatty acids. They're just lower in cholesterol, things like that. So I think waterfowl, they might not be the sexiest answer to that question, but they're definitely super, super hardy and well-suited to this climate.
What are your plans after you've had the animals on the land? Do you rotate them? Is there a plan that you have for that land once it's been occupied by animals?
Yeah, we have kind of a pretty progressive stage, different stages of land. We've only been on our property, let's see, we cleared the northern part of our property. We just finished clearing it last year, right? And so we've only been on our property for about 5 years. We're still kind of in the clearing phase. We have sections of our property that are now established pasture. And by that, we just mean that it is free of stumps. It's relatively smooth. We've seeded the pasture species that we want. We have a little bit more work to do, but it's smooth and grows really nice grass. And that's not something necessarily after that we want to put the pigs on, because pigs do what pigs do best, which is pretty much dig giant holes. But what pigs are very good at doing is in that initial stage of, say, a piece of ground that we haven't cleared out of all the stumps or the down trees yet, they are very good at knocking down all of the understory. They're very good at finding those stumps. They'll dig out. I've seen pigs dig out entire trees before from the ground. It's really impressive. They're really built for that kind of work. So we like to put them on areas that we haven't necessarily cleared yet, but will eventually be future pasture. Once the pigs have done their work, which is basically show us where all the stumps are and where the other things are that we might want to remove, then we come in, and Beau can talk a little bit more about it, but we have some really specialized equipment that allows us to kind of grind all the organic matter in place so it all stays in place in the topsoil, so we don't lose any of that. And then we can start to rotate the other animals through. The animals that like the flat, nice grass, we'll do chickens. We'll do sheep ahead of chickens, so the sheep can basically clip down the grass to a good height for chickens, and then the chickens will follow along behind, and then we have a rotational system that we do for our grazing.
Yeah, I would say this might seem kind of inane to some people, but this is actually the topic that I think most distinguishes our philosophy about land use and what we're most excited about, both in the short term and the long term. And what Aaron kind of alluded to is we're essentially building a profitable, vertically integrated land use system that's designed to function from a very short term cycle, even into a cycle of centuries. So as we kind of said, like, you know, basically we're coming into the land here in Alaska right now at the end of a giant spruce die-off. You know, we with climate change and everything else, we've got, you know, the climate becoming drier in some places, wetter in others. 60% of the spruce trees in Alaska basically have died in the last 30 years. So it's a land on the verge of change. And for us, and animals in combination with some specialized equipment are kind of the vanguard of how we transform that land in flux into something that's a more workable, diverse, long-term system. So to answer your question specifically, like, once we have downed trees and piles of slash and, you know, dead wood kind of cleared out and we've converted to pasture, one of the projects we're working on is we've brought up a lot of other trees and, you know, fruit trees and timber species from farther south, and would like to integrate that into a long-term silvopasture system, where basically you're running livestock under in the lower canopy and having trees and a longer term cycle harvest product above. But the real thing about pastured livestock is it's not so much about what you're raising on the land to provide to consumers. That's super important. It's about the fertility that you're bringing to the land by having your livestock distribute nutrients in an even way without creating a problem doing it. So that's really like the key to the whole thing. But you know, it's a profitable poop distribution system.
One thing that I've realized throughout the season of doing this show is just the most important thing is the dirt.
Yeah.
And the soil in any type of gardening, but and even in pasture livestock raising.
Yeah. Your grass farmers, like your soil farmers.
Did you have any influences on this philosophy?
I mean, I don't think we have invented any of this stuff ourselves. We're heavily influenced by a lot of the work of Joel Salatin with Polyphase Farms, and, you know, kind of the whole like Grange movement, the philosophies of Wendell Berry of like agrarian self-sufficiency and autonomy, community scale agriculture. It's been fun, to the extent that we have done anything unique, it's been fun adapting that kind of ultimately like very, you know, West Virginia temperate sort of climate model, European climate model, to essentially like a boreal ecosystem on the verge of climate change. So there are lots of things with heavy winters and short summers that we do differently than people doing similar things down south would do.
It's been really interesting because, like Beau mentioned, we did have a lot of philosophical influences in the terms of what we are trying to do and how it's been done in other ecosystems. But when we got down to the nitty-gritty of figuring out exactly how this would work for our place, there were not very many, if any, good, well-documented examples. So it's been a really fun project to adapt it to our unique ecosystem that, as we've seen, is literally changing by the year.
Is this the only place like this in Alaska that's doing what you're doing?
I think there are other people who are raising meat chickens at a scale similar to us. I know there are other hog breeders within the state, but I am not aware of anyone else who's vertically integrating and speciating at the scale that we are on such a small footprint. But I would love to be wrong about that. Yeah, I mean, basically we're working on a 20-acre site at this point. We are scaling it up to be larger than that, but most of our footprint at this point is, I mean, for us to turn out the volumes that we do on kind of a small footprint with any one of the species that we do would be kind of unheard of. It's hard to describe to people. Like, people don't really get, well, if you're grazing sheep and you're grazing chickens on it and you're running behind pigs, how does doing more with it allow you to be more productive? And it's just using each function of one animal to deal with the problems or prep the soil or grass for the next one. They actually amplify the productivity of the farm by using different species. It's a pretty complex dance, and Aaron kind of talked about it earlier. But, you know, kind of pigs are the clearing committee, followed by the grazing committee, which is sheep, and then kind of you have a sheep, chicken, hopscotch cycle, and then turkeys and waterfowl kind of filling in the edges, and then mixed with kind of human oversight of crops where the soil is appropriate.
So what do you do differently in the winter for the health and well-being of your animals?
Yeah, I think the biggest change in the winter is that just because of the nature of the ground with ice and snow, the animals don't move as much as they would in the summertime, simply because setting fences is a little bit more difficult in the winter, and there's really no need for them to move as much because the ground isn't being as impacted. But one of the things that we also do for the winter time is we deep bed a lot of our animals, which essentially just means that, say, for the sheep or our layer chickens, rather than like mucking out the layer chickens' coop basically every week so that they have fresh bedding, what we actually do is we continually add a layer of wood chips to the bottom of their coop, and then that deep, it's called deep bedding, it basically just accumulates through the winter, and then during the winter we actually turn that in the layer hutch and some of the other animals and turn that under so that it's composting through the winter. And this does a couple of different things. One is that it actually keeps it warmer in that area because of the composting action of those wood chips and the feces that are being dropped. It also allows them to have access to nice, new, fresh bedding. And then as it composts down, even in the wintertime, you know, we'll see like little worms and little bugs hanging out, and the chickens get to enjoy those as we turn it. So it ends up being a pretty good system.
Yeah, we use a similar model to that, kind of deep bedding. The chickens are kind of the best example. The pigs still move across pasture a little bit, but and the waterfowl, it's similar. Sheep as well. Pretty much we have two completely different systems for summer and winter. Winter is really just about creating beautiful compost with animal feces and then spreading that on the fields in the springtime. Whereas summer is about sending animals out on those fertile fields to harvest the nutrition in the form of grazing.
What are some things that you might look at when you're assessing the health and well-being of your animals?
That's a really good question. I mean, just the one thing that's kind of cute is that when a pig is happy, its tail curls up. So if you ever see a pig with kind of a limp tail, you're like, oh, buddy, what's wrong? Like, how are you feeling? But that's probably not the answer that you wanted. For just basic stuff that we're looking for our animals is their level of activity. Like, are they mentally engaging with their environment? You know, are they bright-eyed? Are they, you know, like active and rooting around in the pig's case or chicken's case? Do they look stimulated? Do they look like they're moving? Physically, like, we're looking at their coat. You know, the pigs in the summertime, they tend to shed their hair and their hair gets thinner, but in the wintertime it comes in, and if it's really shiny and glossy and looks really healthy, just like a human's hair, that tells me that their nutrition is on point, that I'm doing well with what I'm feeding them. Are their eyes bright? Things like that. Just pretty much anything that you would see in a healthy, engaged, active human, that's kind of what we're looking for in our animals.
Yeah, and I think the other aspect of the system that it's kind of underemphasized until you experience it is like you get really good at, on a very intuitive, like interpersonal level, knowing and interacting with the sounds, smells, and behaviors of the different species. Pigs especially are extremely vocal. They make lots of different sounds, lots of different actions. All of our breeding stock, you know, we are in the pens with them several times a day. Even our male boars, which are like 800 pounds and have tusks, like, you know, we can go up and scratch them and pet them, and that's really key for management. So just being the farmer shadow, if you will, like being present and like taking time to pay attention. I think my advice to any new livestock farmer would be like, go out, take a mild substance of your choice, you know, like beer or whatever, and just sit and hang out and like watch your animals for a while, like see what they do, see what they're interested in, and develop your repertoire of rapport and understanding of what that creature is doing and why.
Is there anything that might afflict animals in the wintertime?
I think our biggest issues with, especially with larger animals in this climate, is foot health. Because of wet, cold ground, you really need to select breeds and manage to keep feet from getting rot in the case of sheep, or just pigs really don't like the cold, hard, prickly ground very much. So just making sure that animals have a place where they can go that has dry bedding, where they can dry their feet out and chill out a little bit. I'd say foot health is a big one. Chickens too, just giving them ability to move around. And freezing water.
That's what I was going to say too. I think one of the things that is often overlooked is just dehydration, just making sure that they have access to unfrozen water at all times. That's a big, sometimes a big challenge in the winter, especially if you don't have access to electricity.
Do you guys have access to electricity?
On a portion of our lot, but the majority of our lot does not have access to electricity. So it's a lot of hot water jugs right now, but we've got plans in the next year or so to install electricity to a vast majority of the lot.
How many people does Blood, Sweat, and Foods employ? And what are some of their roles?
So obviously it scales up quite a bit in the summer months, and there's so many people out in the community who also help with really big labor pushes like butchering. We do pay our skilled butchers and eviscerators now, but big thank you to anyone who might be listening who's volunteered with us. But I would say in the summer there's basically four core owners of the business, fill different roles. One of us is kind of like the main farm manager. Everybody else kind of floats on a schedule with chores. I do more of like the big land work kind of stuff. We also usually have anywhere from 2 to 4 interns during the summer months. Those people help in all those facets as well. And then on butcher days or big harvests, we might have 12 plus people.
Do you have one person on staff that's a butcher?
No, that's actually something we've kind of had to learn. And most of our larger, just because customers have very specific needs of what they want to do with meat, we kill and dress pretty much all of our meat on farm. But someone might want to cure their bacon differently than another person, or someone might want a Boston butt instead of like chops. So we work pretty closely with McNeil Canyon Meat and several other processors to actually part out those animals specifically how the customer wants it done.
Mm-hmm. But for all the waterfowl, we do all of that processing ourselves. And yeah, that was something that we learned as we went.
A note to the listeners. At this point in the interview, we talk about the humane killing of animals. We talk about this subject for approximately 5 minutes.
What have you learned in the ethical ways of killing an animal?
Quite a bit, actually. I'll describe poultry because it's what I know best. But for poultry, we learned pretty early on that bleeding out a chicken or a goose is actually the quickest and most ethical way of doing it. And it was actually, it leads to a better meat product as well. Because essentially what happens is the animal's blood pressure drops so quickly that it passes out. And you'll notice a huge difference in the way that we do it. We've had volunteers come and I've shown them how to do it. And when I bleed the animal out, it just falls asleep and that's it. It leads to a much lower stress level in the animal, which ultimately is not only better for the animal, makes me feel morally good about, you know, how I do it, but also that it leads to better meat quality. You don't get the stress hormones. You don't get the tensioning that happens if you do it any other way. So that was really interesting to learn as well.
Yeah, and that might be counterintuitive, just to be maybe slightly more graphic, but this is a really important thing for people to understand about if they're going to eat meat. When you electrocute an animal or you cause massive neurological trauma to the head or something else, the body is an integrated organism, and that trauma, that neurological, like, what just happened to my brain or what just happened, like, resonates throughout the body in the form of release of stress hormones and your limbic system and everything freaking out. When you, and I would even argue that the traditional old world methods, like you hear about like halal or kosher, which basically involve like bleeding out an animal, I would say that's even still, as it is more ethical and less traumatic for poultry, I believe that's probably true for larger animals as well. And that's for smaller sheep, that is what we do as well. Because as soon as, if the heart is allowed to engage to essentially pump the circulatory system of the animal dry and they lose perfusion, not only do those stress hormones not circulate, the animal's consciousness fades in a way that the body is more comfortable with. The body recognizes the absence of a critical component like the brain, but with a loss of blood pressure and perfusion, the body, like Aaron says, the animal tends to just fall asleep. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but far more humane. And you can tell with the meat, and you can tell with the experience of, you know, harvesting that animal in an ethical way, for sure.
Is bleeding just slitting the throat?
So it's actually, if you can do it right, like most animals, if you feel kind of like on your neck, if you were to feel your pulse with your finger on either side of your neck, mm-hmm. your carotid arteries, you have two of them, are kind of near the surface. So with the chicken, what we do is we invert it, which calms the chicken. This is true of the poultry as well. And we just try to make just a slit into that carotid artery without cutting into the throat or the trachea or anything else. So it's a very, very minimal cut, but basically what happens is the animal's circulatory system pumps the blood out of the animal while the animal is essentially just like, what's going on? You see it. I actually made a video for staff a couple of years ago, but that just, the animal just falls asleep because its blood supply is just pumped out in as least traumatic a way possible. Whereas if you were like, a lot of people are like, oh, you just wring its neck or cut a chicken's head off. That's very traumatic to the chicken. The body is like, where's the brain? You know, and it panics as a result. So that's, I don't know if that helps people visualize it.
Yeah, and I think also we take a lot of care to make sure that our knives are extremely sharp, which means that when you cut those carotids in the manner that he's describing, a lot of times, like, the chicken doesn't even know that anything happened, and then it just passes out. So it's remarkable, like, what a quiet process it ends up being. Like, multiple people have told me, wow, that was not what the traumatic experience that I was expecting.
Do the animals, do you just have them all in a line and just go down the line and they witness all of their brothers and sisters getting killed? Do they react?
It's interesting, like, obviously the distinction between like livestock farmers and like vegetable farmers is that livestock farmers harvest animals and animals are living beings. Different animals have different levels of awareness of their environment. And I think the thing that we really focus on is minimizing sources of stress or concern for the animal. So a chicken really doesn't have much conception if it necessarily has like line of sight to another chicken as to what's happening, as long as it's maybe with its buddies and calm up until the final moment, or preferably during the final moment. Pigs, on the other hand, have a very distinct, they're disturbed by the knowledge that something bad is happening to its buddy. So with pigs, we always make sure that we harvest pigs where the others cannot see them, and we always make sure to not traumatically move them to a new location or transport them or stress them before it happens. We actually harvest all our pigs literally in the pasture where they are. We call it a butcher box, but basically we frame in a protected area where the other pigs cannot see. We lead one in at a time. We give it its last meal. It has no idea what's happening and it's over. We have just found that through experience to be the most practically least traumatic way, because for us, we're not only concerned about the animal's welfare, but we want a meat that is free of stress going to our customer as well.
What tends to stress out animals most is being chased being in an environment where they aren't with their other animals that they naturally are. For the chickens, like, we have, you know, comfortable small crates that we keep them in until it's time for that one chicken to be processed. It stays with its buddies. It's a system that allows us to not have to chase the chicken around and stress it out. We just pick it up, it stays calm, it's processed, and that's it. But yeah, like Bo said, different animals have different levels of awareness of what's going on. And we take that into consideration when we design the processing system. It's really something that actually a lot of thought goes into so that we can do it in a way that is, again, focusing on the least stressful situation possible. And over the years, we've done a very good job of recognizing where each animal is at in its level and designing a system that matches it.
Are there any animals you keep for breeding purposes, or maybe you have a different kind of relationship with?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, I think, over 10 breeding pigs now whose primary role is producing other piglets. And that's true for geese as well. This year we're keeping some breeding turkeys. You know, layer chickens stay with us for multiple years. So we definitely have, I mean, we have favorite pigs on the farm. We have one pig who will stay with us for as long as she would like. Her name is Freya, and she's the last pig that we have that was from our original founding stock of Tamworth pigs, and we just adore her. So we definitely have animals that have different roles on the farm, and lots of them that we get accustomed, you know, that we enjoy. We get connected with our animals. We never try to make them other. We never try to, like, emotionally distance ourselves to the point where it's just easy for us to process them. We do it in a way that we feel morally really good about. And like I said, we take a lot of time to design our processing system so that it is doing right by the animal. And we get attached to all of them.
Yeah, and I would say, too, kind of circling back a little bit to your point about heritage livestock, one of the real tragedies of the modern industrial livestock system is it is, to a great extent, bred longevity out of breeding stock. What I mean by that is it takes an investment and it takes time to get a sow or a ewe to a point where, you know, she's going to be a good and healthy mom. In the industrial breeding system, we've bred it so that, you know, those animals maybe have a useful life of 3-4 years, and then they're off to the feedlot or they're off to the slaughterhouse. When you've got heritage breed, you can select for, and this is something we're very deliberately doing on our farm, selecting for stock that has a more vigorous, healthy, longer productive life as breeding stock. And that's one of the reasons we're so fond of Freya is, you know, she's almost 6 years old, somewhere in there, and she still produces 2 very healthy litters of piglets a year. She roots well, she's really active, and that's something that we look for as we grow with our farm and, like, select breeds and select stock. We want the animals that live longer and better lives and pass those traits on.
And at the end of the day, you cannot farm the way that we do without knowing your animals, without paying attention to them, without understanding their different personalities and what their proclivities are, what they're likely to do in certain scenarios. And that means that you know them intimately.
Do you guys ever offer farm tours? Or back before COVID, would you have, you know, school groups come and visit?
Absolutely. We have an open farm policy for all of our customers. If you're a customer of ours and you want to come see the farm and how we raise our animals and what we do, we are more than happy to schedule a time for you to do that. We also offer farm tours to people that aren't customers for a pretty low fee, just to cover our time that it takes. If they want to come see how the farm is run, or we're more than happy to take them around and show them how that's done. We've had multiple school groups in the past. You know, we've had SVT, we've hosted people from there. Kids groups are one of our favorites because kids just see farms in a different way than adults do, and we just love having them. So yeah, before COVID, we had groups of people come, and we're always happy to schedule time to do it. It's really important to us that people feel that they can understand the system that their food is provided from. So we absolutely love it when we have customers that say, hey, I'm really enjoying your products and I'd really like to see how you guys do what you do. We're very transparent in how we run our operation, and we love showing customers that.
Do you guys have any turkeys left?
We do not. We typically sell out of our turkeys Usually by the end of the October, honestly. And most of our returning customers, they know the deal and they put down their deposits in July for turkeys. But every year we're increasing the number of turkeys we do and there's still a demand. So,
yeah, one thing is true. And as soon as Thanksgiving passes, we will relist 2021 turkeys. And we charge just a very small deposit if you want to reserve a turkey. So if you missed it this year, set a reminder for early December, go on our website, reserve a 2021 turkey. That really helps us order enough to meet demand. We've doubled the number of turkeys we've done each year, but each year we sell out early.
I want to put in a plug for geese too. For all of the people that maybe didn't get turkeys, geese are delicious. They are not very hard to cook. They cook faster than a turkey, but they are very good, and I promise you they're not as intimidating as they seem. We do have a few geese left, but honestly, it's our favorite poultry for holidays. Absolutely. We always have one for Christmas, and oftentimes we'll have one for Thanksgiving instead of a turkey, and man, it's hard to describe how delicious they are. They're very, very good.
And for locavores out there, goose is, in my opinion, the most place-based appropriate domestic meat. It tastes great, and like those geese are... 95% of what they eat is grown in the soil here.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's kind of a Christmas, like a Dickens Christmas. They talk about the Christmas goose.
Yeah, I think it's very popular in Europe. I've had a lot of people come to me and say, that just seems not quite right, or I wouldn't know how to cook it. But most of the people that have purchased geese from me, they always come back because they're like, oh, I'm so glad I tried that. It was definitely worth it.
Do you have other meats available for the holiday season?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we still have some geese left. We also have half and whole lambs available, and those should be ready, I think, before Christmas. So those are available. We are always taking deposits for half and whole hogs as well, but right now the whole hogs that will be ready for processing in March. So if you place your deposit now, you'll most likely be for the March processing. And then chicken. We have chicken year-round, actually. A lot of people think that we only have it in the summer, but we have it in the winter as well, and it's really hard to describe how it's so delicious. It's if you've had only store-bought chicken, please try one of our chickens. You'll never go back.
The other thing, too, is we do have what's called a Farmer's Choice CSA and a Sausage CSA, which is basically, if that's mostly what you would use pork for anyway, it's just a monthly subscription. We'll bring like mixed cuts of meat or, you know, pretty much just pork sausage to you and deliver it as well. So that's available right now as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans or vision for the future of the farm?
So many.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we don't maybe get to emphasize enough is our farm is actually part of a small group of businesses that are very closely integrated. Our core philosophy comes from just one question, which is how do we live better, more sustainably, more autonomously, more profitably, and in a more healthful way in this place? And that even harkens to the core value of this collective of businesses, the first of which is agency and autonomy, and health is the second. And for us, our agriculture operations, blood, sweat, and food, is part of a larger ability to optimize land for its best use. So we have a sister company that does land clearing and organic products and soil and things like that. We have a bookkeeping company that kind of is the small business backbone, you know, the back office logistics that allows all these other business enterprises to function well. And we provide bookkeeping services to a lot of nonprofits and other local businesses. So it's really just kind of creating that system, creating that group, and creating an avenue for any kind of person or skill set to, if they want to work hard and apply themselves, having a place where they can have a lifestyle and an economic sustenance that is a living wage. That's really what it's all about, is we want to live here, we want to live here right, and we understand that people are different, they have different strengths, they have different weaknesses, they have different, you know, even different moral proclivities. We feel like there's a place if they want to take responsibility for their future and making it viable here. So that's a really big component of the ethos of what like launched this whole thing.
So I'm getting down in time-wise, so I wanted to ask if you guys had anything that you wanted to say or anything that I might have missed.
I think one of the coolest things from a customer standpoint, if you're not like, I don't want to butcher animals myself, I don't want to necessarily do all that, but I'm glad somebody's doing it. The thing I love about our farm is our meat and our produce speaks for itself. Just try it. Just go to the store and buy a chicken and go online to our website or through the food hub or anywhere else and buy one of our chickens, put them side by side, and if you cannot taste the difference, I will examine your taste buds myself.
How could they not take advantage of that? Right? What a good deal.
Or maybe don't put that in there.
Yeah, okay. You kind of have to put it in there. You ended your sentence on it.
You should probably end it better than that, Aaron. Go ahead. Oh. Nail it.
Your face is getting red. We take pride in the ethical and moral implications of what we do. The way that we farm is better for the environment. The way that we farm is better for the animals that are participating in our system. The way that we farm is healthier for the people that are consuming the products that it produces. But at the end of the day, it's really exciting that our food tastes better. It is a better product than what you can buy at the store. I've had multiple people come and tell me that it's not even really our chicken versus store-bought chicken that they've had. They say it's not even the same thing. And that feels really good because I know that how I'm farming is better for the ecosystem and it's better for me as a person. But I also just love that it's a better product. It just feels like a win-win-win all the way around. And it's a great feeling.
I think one other thing you reminded me of in saying that a lot of our customers have a little bit of confusion about is kind of like the difference between organic or not organic and what that means in the meat sphere. I definitely don't want to down on any system above any other one. And I definitely, all other things being equal, when I'm in the grocery store, I'm going to choose an organic product over a not organic product. But we are not a certified organic farm. Just doing so bureaucratically would be very difficult at the scale that we're at right now. Know that the experience that an animal has can be, I would argue, can be as important, arguably more important than perhaps some of the elements that are in some of the feed. Obviously, we source all of our feed locally when we can. Most of our livestock are fed a barley ration. This is grown in-state in Delta Junction, which is really the most local, low pesticide use option that we can source at scale for the kind of livestock that we're feeding. But an organic chicken can still be raised in a factory for all intents and purposes. It's just fed feed that's certified organic. And I think a chicken that is outside on fresh pasture each day, eating bugs in the fresh air, I would make the argument that chicken is a superior product than a factory-raised organic chicken. So just it's important to keep in mind what these different labels mean, and all other things being equal, I would say that pasture-based livestock or truly free-range livestock or livestock grown by a farmer who knows that livestock by name is always going to be better than an industrial livestock product that might have a better label. So that's really important for people to keep in mind.
Do you want to talk about other people that are interested in doing what we do?
Yeah. If you're interested in doing what we do, come talk to us and talk to us about joining our team or synergizing with our efforts. I can't remember the name of the article, but I read recently why small family farms are a terrible idea. And this might sound really strange coming from people who are essentially running a relatively small farm, but the reality is the mythological aspiration of a small livestock farm that is profitable as a livestock farm is probably inaccessible for most people in a sustainable way, because there's a certain minimum threshold of infrastructure that you need to do this stuff right. And, you know, a good example is, you know, we have over $35,000 invested in poultry butchering and processing equipment. There's no way that we could raise the number of chickens we do each year, package them and deliver them to people for anywhere near a competitive price point without having a minimum volume and a minimum threshold. So I would say the co-op model and the synergizing model and the, hey, what are you good at? You know, I'm good at this. Let's combine forces and make a better solution is always going to be preferable to the, have everybody kind of have their own tiny little silos. You know, I think next scale, community scale for this area, it's going to be like, hey, let's get like a true community DEC kitchen in place. Hey, let's get like a true butchering animal processing in place. Hey, let's do a community scale like root cellar, like this big collective infrastructure that's for profit model. I mean, we're hardcore capitalists too. We're all about, you know, making things truly economically viable. That's at the core of what we believe. But that's where I would encourage people wanting to get into this to focus rather than trying to reinvent the wheel. And I think a lot of our success came from not thinking that we could do something better that other people might have already figured out, and building on their shoulders rather than trying to reinvent the wheel.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been awesome. Please don't put everything I said in there.
I'm going to put that in, though.
And that was Bo Burgess and Aaron Young of Blood, Sweat, and Food Farm, recorded at their home on November 10th, 2020. Coming up next, Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of current news and opportunities in local ag.
From Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. Homer Grown may be taking a winter break, but that doesn't mean you have to stop getting good local insight on growing your own food or local land topics. Homer Soil and Water and the Homer Office of NRCS have begun our winter series of talks called Know Your Land. The first one was a discussion on soil erosion, and the next one will be held this coming Tuesday, November 17th. The topic this Tuesday is Principles of Soil Health and will be presented by Homer Soil and Water's soils guy, Brad Kassar. If you're into soil health, this talk's for you. Brad will cover soil armor, minimizing soil disturbance, plant diversity, continual live plant root and livestock integration, and he'll also discuss the upcoming cover crop demonstrations, where our team will be trialing a wide range of cover crop species on local soil to chart how well they work in our area. Meeting online via Zoom and at two times. Brad will do his presentation at 11:30 a.m. and at 6 p.m. We try to accommodate most people's schedules with these talks. Talks are free and open to the public. Bring your questions. For the registration link to either of the two sessions, visit our website's homepage at homerswcd.org. You can look forward to many of these Know Your Land talks throughout the winter months. December's topics will be on forestry, wildfire, and fire breaks. More topics to come, so follow us on Facebook or sign up for our Ag Updates e-newsletter on our website. If you have any questions, contact Nicole at homerswcd.org. And speaking of that cover crop trial, if you have raw land and you'd like to be a part of these cover crop trials, let us know. We're still lining up the properties that we'll be doing the trials on. Reach out to Brad and let him know you're interested. Just shoot him an email to brad@homerswcd.org. If you like living off the beaten path and with internet service, the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies is looking for a year-round caretaker for the Inspiration Ridge Preserve. This is the perfect position for someone who is working part-time and loves the outdoors. Must enjoy wildlife and be capable of outdoor work such as shoveling snow, chopping brush, running a weed whacker and a chainsaw, and hiking backcountry areas around the preserve. In exchange for approximately 20 hours a week of trail work and maintenance, the caretaker has a cabin provided with running water, electricity, internet, and a septic system. Visit the Coastal Studies website for details or contact Beth Trowbridge at 235-6756. This winter, when the weather's nice and the bears are hibernating, it's a great time to explore the Homer Demonstration Forest up off Rogers Loop Road on Baycrest Hill. The Demonstration Forest covers 360 acres and connects with the Homestead Trail System and offers trails all the way down to the Diamond Creek drainage. There's signage at the trailhead, and parking along Rogers Loop Road. If you've got ideas for educational opportunities that can be held at the Demonstration Forest, contact the Forest Steering Committee, comprised of locals from a variety of community groups. You can reach out to them on the newly created Homer Demonstration Forest Facebook group. I'm very happy to announce that Homer has a new local business in town, Sweet Gale Mead Works and Cider House. Local fermentation craftsman Jason Davis recently opened a brand new local craft beverage tasting room where he offers his hard apple ciders and meads. The best part is that he's using only local ingredients. He's a beekeeper himself, and he's sourcing more local honey, local berries, and rhubarb for his fine products. You can find Jason and the Mead Works on Main Street in downtown Homer, in the little building out behind where Timeless Toys used to be. Go show your love for local foods. And on a final note, and speaking of local foods, in case you haven't heard, the Alaska Food Hub is extending their season this year through December. This is the first time the Food Hub will be open through the holiday season, so check out what goodies you can pick up for yourself or loved ones this season. Of course, there's winter storage veggies, but there's also locally made foods and locally made self-care products and fun treats like that. Offerings change weekly. Visit alaskafoodhub.org Fridays through Mondays to get in on the good stuff and keep our dollars local.
And that's it for this episode. I want to thank Aaron Young and Beau Burgess of Blood, Sweat, and Food Farm for talking to us about pasture-raised livestock. Because this is the last episode of this season, I wanted to extend my thanks to a few more people. This year, we interviewed 30 individuals, and I want to thank them for their time, their energy, their knowledge, and their passion. Thank you so much for sharing it with me and the community. I need to thank Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Brad Kassar, Catherine Shakey, Kyra Wagner, and Nicola Revelo for appearing on numerous episodes and sharing their expertise. I especially need to thank Nicola Revelo, who has been the hidden hand in this show, helping with the logistics of scheduling interviews and field recordings, as well as just being fun and putting up with me. I want to thank KBBI for the opportunity to do this show. Jeff Lockwood for training me to be a producer, and also for all the times that he has responded to my texts when I have a technical issue. As always, I need to thank the local musicians who have contributed their music to this show. Carly Konimak and Kevin Cope for our intro music. Ryan Black for the interstitial music. And Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for our outro music. I would like to thank our underwriters, The Wagon Wheel, for supporting this show. And most importantly, I want to thank you, the listeners. Thank you especially to people that have reached out and talked to me about the show or emailed feedback. It's really a great motivation to keep going, keep learning, and keep growing. We hope to pick the show back up in a few months. Questions, comments, or criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.